Welcome to this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two men in the middle of the country get together, talk about politics, current events, and other cool stuff. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Koenig.
And once again, the enemy of the amateur podcaster is work.
It is.
So last week, our work lives and our need to actually create revenue to support our lives got in the way of us doing a podcast.
Right. I was out of town last week for annual company meeting slash summit slash team building. So it was at one time of the year where our entire company gets together because we're all remotely distributed all over the world, and was in Orlando for, between 8 and 10 days. A little bit over that.
That's a lot of time.
That was a lot of
in Orlando.
It was a lot of time.
Did you spend all 8 to 10 days on a Disney property?
No, I was off.
That is horrible.
I was off property for some of that, and then I was on property for the actual team meeting and during the team building get-togethers. But yeah, very humid, very hot. So I went from like 95 degrees ultra humidity, and then got back to town here, and it drops down to the 40s. So
so I was in New York City Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We got there Wednesday in the afternoon. It was 93 degrees.
Wow.
Rolling through Manhattan. The next day, Thursday morning, I think it was 54. So
that's incredible.
It just turned
temperature drop. Yeah.
93 or 94 in New York City is hotter than hell.
Well, yeah, all that steel,
brutal,
and concrete. Yeah, and the reflection. Yeah, that's unbearable.
So I've been to Disney properties a few times. Was this your first foray into Disney, or have you been there before?
Well, it was the first time staying on a Disney property. Yes.
Yeah.
So I was a little bit unfamiliar with that, and it was interesting to say the least. I admire Disney's model. Because they price gouge the heck out of you, and I see how they make their money.
And you just accept it.
Right.
When you're there with your kids, you just know, well, that just costs what it wants.
Although it's still sticker shock to me, $4.25 for a Coke out of the vending machine.
So I just want to replay what you just said. You walk up to a vending machine. Hey, I'm going to get a can of Coke before I turn in for the night. It's $4.25.
Right. Hmm. And on property, no matter where you get like a soda, they keep the price consistent, and that goes through all the parks too. There is no deviation. There is no trying to find the lower price. There's no cheap way to get through it. Everything's the same. Although it was helpful because we had a gas station right outside the property in walking distance where you could get a Coke for a buck. So
I was always a big fan of everybody in the country that has kids. Just we write Disney a check for like $200 and they shut everything down.
Yeah,
your properties, your movies, all of that bullshit. We just get rid of it in one shot.
Well, and they just raised park prices. They raised parking. So they have preferred parking now, which is $50 a day.
That's insane.
Isn't that crazy?
How much is a ticket to get into Disney?
So
Epcot or one of those things.
So a ticket for one park one day is about $115. And then if you want to do multi-day and add park hoppers so you can go back and forth between parks, I mean, if you want to do all four parks, 4 days, and do park hopper, you're looking at about $600 a person.
That's insane. Yeah. And then, like, for an extra $200 or $300, you could pay to, like, cut the line.
Right.
So you can actually enjoy the park other than just walking through and standing in a hot line with a bunch of people.
Yes. Add that. Add parking on top of that. Add what you're going to pay for food when you're there. And then, it just multiplies.
Again, I come off as the old man grumpy. I can't stand Disney. Crowds. Kids, heat, it all is just a big bowl of uckiness that I'm never going back to again.
There's a couple of the rides I like, but the problem is there's so much walking at the parks, and there's really, when you get down to it, the attractions are kind of minimal. And so everything that you're there to do, like everything is like a cost. There's a cost incurred. So it's like buy this, go see this, and you're going to have to pay for this. So I like it, but then I get tired of it fast, and then I'm like, okay, I'm done. Like,
so professional Podway segue, let's talk to a guy who didn't have as good a week as you did last week, the president of the United States. We missed one
a trend
week
for him
in potting, and again, where do we even start with the president and everything that happened last week in the non kind of quasi impeachment process that we've started at this point?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we had more come out about the original whistleblower. We had validation now with the second whistleblower who is also speaking out, whose identity is hasn't been revealed yet. And there's been great care taken to ensure his identity is not his or her identity is not compromised due to all the rhetoric by the president and his allies. So that situation is heating up, and it's interesting to see Republicans on the Hill, the lack of response, just like going silent, because they're, the problem is we're at a point now where it's indefensible because you have the audio of the call, you have more information that's coming out about that it wasn't just one call, that there's a series of interactions, there's more coming out, so it's quickly escalated, and so we have this impeachment inquiry that's beginning. We know that the dynamics haven't changed. The Senate is not likely to convict still.
No.
So we're still at that point. But the tide is turning in terms of polling, because I think Americans are recognizing that what was done was not normal. It wasn't above board. And you have polling now that shows either half to slightly above half of Americans favor an impeachment, which is really incredible to think about, because at this point in time and during Nixon's Watergate scandal, the polling didn't reflect.
It was like 12%.
Right.
It was very low. What got me with the Fox News poll, it wasn't only impeachment, it was impeachment and removal.
Yes.
That 51% think the current president should be removed from office.
Which is interesting, because the president went on one of his Twitter rants the other day.
You're going to have to be more specific.
There's so many now. Yeah. He's kind of devolved into just constant meltdown mode on Twitter now. It's not even like every other day, it's constant. But he basically was saying, you know, that he was stroking the fire about a witch hunt, and he threw out the number that only 25% of Americans want to impeach him. And so several pundits were trying to figure out where he got the number from, and they think that he took that out of an internal poll of Republicans, because often he will conflate Republicans and use numbers of Republicans
to everything.
But even looking at that, if there are 25% of Republicans now that favor impeachment, that is significant, considering that that would be a major increase from where it was just a couple weeks ago.
I've seen that poll number on Republicans anywhere from 13% to 25%.
Yeah.
So if we kind of split the difference, it's somewhere around that 15 to 18%.
Right.
Which I agree. Once it gets to consistently 25% or above 25%, now you've got a serious problem. If you lose a third of Republicans to the impeachment question, now's when you have to start wondering when is the dam going to break, and the drumbeat for him from members of his own party to leave is going to take effect.
So that's interesting. But what I find out even more interesting is his team's strategy of defiance. They are not complying with any subpoenas from the House. They issued, did you see the letter they issued where it was like 8-page letter on
literally the, you and I could have written that letter.
It was garbage.
There was nothing lawyerly about that letter.
I mean, it was complete garbage. It would not hold up in court.
Hack job.
It was a hack job, but it was also just a judgment call saying that they don't find the impeachment effort constitutionally valid, whatever that means. First of all, it is constitutionally valid just by the fact that the House has decided to open it, because that is in the House's right and purview. And so all of it is just
That's a great point. And let's unpack this for a second, because this is the Republicans' primary line of attack. This is invalid because they have not held an official vote to launch an impeachment inquiry.
And let's be clear, there is nothing in the Constitution that specifies what type of process they have to undertake.
Article 1 gives oversight to the president. Powers to Congress. It is completely within their preview to investigate for impeachment and to apply that oversight in any way that they see fit. There is nothing that's not above board or unconstitutional about how they are going about this impeachment.
So, but if this is a new chapter, instead of just evading, they have outright challenged now the constitutional authority of the House to conduct impeachment investigations.
But let's talk, what is the Republicans' complaint? The Republicans' complaint is that in the precedent of Nixon and Clinton, there was a vote to officially launch an impeachment inquiry. An official inquiry.
Vote. Yeah.
That is the step that the Democrats did not do. But to your point,
but that's not constitutionally
there
is no required.
Constitutional requirement, and it does not illegitimize the investigation.
Not at
the
all.
Process they're currently going on.
Yeah, there is nothing that signifies that that has to happen. And you know, and in fact, though, I know that Democrats are now are considering whether or not to do that, just to take away that as a Republican talking point.
Yep.
So you take that off the table, which they can. But again, that is just a obstruction tactic and delay tactic. Because the White House attorneys have to know that this is not going to hold up in court. As soon as it gets reported, you know, the judges are going to toss this. But again, it's about delay, to try to delay this as much as possible, throw up roadblocks, obstruct, and that's going to be their tactic going forward. I did find it interesting, in court, the president's attorneys argued that Watergate was wrongly decided, and they used that. And did you see the reaction of the judge?
The judge is like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
He's like, really? Did you just say that?
This is the worst legal document that's ever been presented to me.
I mean, what does that say about you and your confidence in your case? Did you have to cite Watergate and say that that was wrongly decided?
Well, If you follow George Conway on Twitter,
yeah.
which
I recommend
everybody
to
do.
He is phenomenal, yeah.
He went on Parit, God, I can't say the gentleman's last name, the Southern District of New York's...
What is it, Bagava or...
It's called Stay Tuned, I think, with Parit is the podcast.
I saw him the other day talking about his interview with
Conway.
Conway,
I don't think, has done an interview in more than a year and a half.
No.
They spend about an hour together. It's a little bit thick legal because they're both lawyers, and anytime two lawyers to get together, they like to talk in lawyer speak. But he does an excellent job of kind of debunking, to your point, this letter, this argument, this unconstitutional argument is complete BS.
Right.
And it will not stand up in any way, shape, or form if the Democrats choose to push it to go to court.
And, you know, I think the Democrats should be, you know, aggressive on it and say, fine, have at it, you know, if you want to. But again, the other option is to just take that off the table as an argument, hold a formal vote on an impeachment inquiry and go from there and, you know, take it away. Because outside of that, what talking points are left? What type of defense is left? I mean, if they're grasping at that, I mean, that's pretty pitiful.
So I listen to Ben Shapiro almost on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I catch a lot of flack from my Democratic friends when I bring up Ben Shapiro. And typically they say, well, this is just your gateway drug to becoming a conservative. Why don't you listen to Rush Limbaugh and just register as a Republican? I disagree with probably 85% of what Shapiro says, but he had a very succinct answer to the question, why haven't Republicans en masse came out and attacked or turned on President Trump? Why has there been absolute radio silence? And his explanation is something that made sense. And he basically said, we still haven't crossed over yet into a territory with Trump that you can say the Democrats are guilty of the exact same thing. And we're going to have to find a spot for Trump to be removed from the presidency, for Republicans to turn on Trump and to get the 22 votes for impeachment or to force him out, because I don't think it would ever go to a full Senate trial.
No.
It would be halfway through. Somebody would approach him and say, this is terrible. You're going to be impeached. And he would
resign.
Nixon and resign. For that to happen, this investigation has to lead somewhere where the argument is, but the Democrats did the exact same thing. And I'll give you an example.
Okay.
In 2016, Hillary Clinton's campaign approached the Ukrainian government about an investigation into Paul Manafort.
Right.
When Paul Manafort became, or they were investigating Manafort under the guise of corruption. And then when Manafort became Trump's campaign manager, they expanded that investigation. So for a lot of Republicans, we have not hit the point yet where what you're accusing the president of, your side has already done.
So what you're saying is that it has to reach a point in the investigation where facts are revealed where action was taken that went beyond anything that would have happened on the other side.
Yes.
There has to be a turning point.
Because everybody agrees, and even Shapiro agrees, what Trump did was horrible, it was wrong, and it's probably impeachable.
Yeah.
I think everybody agrees with that space.
And there is a difference with the commander-in-chief doing that, the president versus yes. someone who's running for president, yes. the office.
But Republicans aren't splitting those hairs.
Yeah, and I think you're right.
This kind of avalanche.
It has to be black and white, absolutely. Clear-cut
and
difference.
And something that we feel your side didn't do or doesn't do all the time. And I thought that made a ton of sense.
So that you can take away the whataboutism.
Correct.
That the Republicans currently employ.
He's got to get into a territory that you can say, this is kind of new.
Yeah.
This level of corruption we have not seen out of the other side, and there is no, I can forgive this because you did that. And until it crosses over there, don't expect any real in mass Republican senators or congressmen to change their tune on Trump. That at least makes sense to me. I can understand where somebody on the Republican side at least is coming from. Let me go on record. I disagree with that. I think that's a total bullshit way to look at right. this. But at least there's some logic and it makes some sense to why you haven't seen Republicans in mass come out and condemn this behavior.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that it's been interesting because Republicans from swing states are just refusing to answer questions.
Cory Gardner,
yeah,
the other day, just
he was.
Just
I saw that. That was the one I thought of. Yeah,
he's toast.
Oh
there's
yeah,
no
I can't
way
see
he
that he
survives.
Wins re-election
in Colorado. That's going to be interesting. But I think he's got to be gone.
Yeah, and he won in a good year. Ran as a pragmatist yes. moderate. He was endorsed by the Denver Post at the time, and they've rescinded that endorsement. Yeah. They came out with this endorsement saying we were wrong. We yeah. wish we never endorsed yeah. him. That type of yeah.
They kicked him in the nuts pretty hard.
They
when
did.
They decided we are not going to endorse you for the next one. So I think for me it's. There's a risk Democrats are running to get to that point to where you have to find the level of corruption that makes Republicans forget about what they feel the Democrats are guilty of. That's going to take a long, long time to get there. And let's be honest, like the Mueller investigation, we may not connect those dots.
And do you fear that it's going to become just like the Mueller investigation, too convoluted? There's going to be
yes.
too many rabbit holes.
Yep.
We're starting to see that a little bit. I mean, with like Giuliani's associates being indicted yeah. and arrested. And there definitely looks to be a lot in play here. And I think that we're going to see several elements of criminality involved. But the problem is, does it become too complex to make that case?
And how exhausted are we right now?
Yeah.
To get through
to follow
it all
before we just go, okay, this is too much. I can't
see. I think the Giuliani thing that kind of fits into this nice identifiable area to most voters. These
right.
were two, they were born in Russia, but I think they were American citizens.
They were, well, they were Ukrainian, born in the Soviet Union.
Okay.
So Soviet born businessmen. They were living in Florida.
Yes.
I don't recall if they were American citizens or not. But yes, so they have longtime ties with Giuliani going
yes.
way, way back. I think he defended them in another case previously. So they have been charged with election fraud, campaign
yeah.
fraud, bribery. Basically, the charges include funneling money for campaign contributions from Russia to the
yeah.
Trump campaign, bundling contributions. So they, and then their involvement too with what's going on right now with the phone calls with Trump and
yeah.
the Ukrainian prime minister. So there's a lot to unpack there. But yes, it does feed into this narrative because you had Giuliani there as president's personal
yeah.
lawyer involved in trying to make this public case and lay on this pressure to Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden and his son, making numerous trips to Ukraine,
yeah.
meeting with numerous officials. It created this disconnect where there were officials in the State Department and in other parts of the government that didn't understand or were unaware of why Giuliani was being sent in this
yeah.
capacity as a non-government official. So, and then the fact that you have these individuals involved who have now been indicted for, and this criminal investigation is far-reaching, includes not just them, but they're investigating what Giuliani said and did. So Giuliani could really come under heavy scrutiny and could even be charged out of all of this. And the irony out of all of this is this: these two guys in the continuing investigation, of which Giuliani may be charged, is being handled by the Southern District of New York. That's the district that Giuliani led as prosecutor before he was mayor. You can't make this stuff up.
But those two guys, I think most Americans can wrap their mind around who those two guys are. Those are bad guys.
Bad guys.
Those are dirty guys who came over here to spread money around, to specifically buy influence, who hang out with a sleazy crowd, who got caught with, I think they went to dinner with Giuliani, and then the next day got arrested with one-way tickets to get the hell out of the country.
Well, and that's why, I mean, this was a very quiet investigation, but the reason this came out was because they had to act fast to arrest these guys because they were leaving the country as fast as they were.
But I think I get that. That, and then you put the visual of those guys. There's a video where they're with Giuliani where they're all just looking like they're having some sort of mobbed up dinner or something. That all, as an American citizen, I can wrap my mind around that. And that looks really, really, really fishy.
I think what the
Dems are going to do is they're going to pick four or five high points, subpoenaing Giuliani and letting him either melt down in front of everybody or deny the subpoena. You know, there's getting Sundland. I think he is going to actually come in next week, and he's actually defying the DOJ.
Oh, I hadn't heard that. He is defying
He's actually going to come in next week.
Well, and again, that is a critical moment. The fact that Trump is refusing to let these officials testify, that does not speak to the administration's lack of culpability in any of this. So that'll be a turning point. There is the... Gosh, I'm blanking out on the role, but the Ukrainian, is it the Ukrainian ambassador, the former, who is also testifying?
She testified today.
Today, right. I did not hear what was
said. She was behind closed doors.
Right.
And she basically, what I heard on the way over was that the DOJ barred her late last night from coming.
Yeah.
The Congress issued a snap subpoena to her immediately to say, okay, now we're subpoenaing you, and she came in today.
Okay. Because I wondered how that worked out, how she was able to get past the administration's...
Yeah. They issued her a subpoena late last night as a vehicle to get her here. Because there was a lot of reporting that people in the White House, even up to 8, 9 o'clock this morning, had no idea if she would actually testify or not.
And this wasn't the official who was fired, right? She is still
isn't it's that Yelena Mala. I'm not even gonna attempt
I know
name. I think this was the actual Ukrainian ambassador.
Okay, because there was one official who's been spoken about who was fired.
I'm looking that up real quick.
And I think the one who was fired, the administration wouldn't hold any sway over forbidding.
She's still a member of the DOJ.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. She's still a member of the State Department. She was released from her position as ambassador.
But she's still
an employee.
Oh, that's why. Okay.
That's why they pulled that with them. But here's where I'm coming from. I think the Dems are going to cherry pick a few people to come in that they know are going to put facts in evidence. This is going to go on till probably a little bit after Thanksgiving. They're going to continue to watch the polling, which has gained anywhere between 8 to 12 points in support of impeachment since this thing started. Remember, we're only 2 weeks into this. It feels like 2 years, but we've only been at this for 2 weeks. They're going to let this go about another 6 weeks. They're going to pull some people in that can add to the narrative, and then they're going to pass their articles of impeachment. I don't think they're going to let this stretch out very long because they know there's no way that this dies in the Senate.
No, and I think that with recent events and recent revelations combined with the polling, there is less and less downside to holding an impeachment vote even if it doesn't go anywhere. I think that the public now is the growing momentum is behind the effort. So, you know, even knowing that there will not be conviction in the Senate, they will be able to, if they can make the case and do it coherently, cohesively, and again, not get bogged down in the weeds, I think it will just bolster their case and it'll go right into the election.
The only other strategy is you keep this going through the election.
Yeah.
So if he wins, you try to impeach him. There's no way that That's the worst possible scenario.
Yeah, that is.
And we talked about during warm-up, if this was any other president, we would say, who cares? He's toast. There's no way he survives this. The only president that I could think of in history that could possibly wiggle his way off this hook and wiggle his way through re-election is Trump. He's the only person that possibly could have any chance to survive what's happening right now. Not only survive, but be re-elected.
It's crazy. And, you know, he's becoming more and more unhinged at his rallies, too. I don't know if you saw his rally in Minnesota.
Did you watch any of that live?
No, I didn't watch it live. I saw some of the sound bites and I read some of the
transcript. I watched like 10 minutes later of it live. It's just, again,
he's becoming more and more crass, too, which I didn't think he could be, which is also
okay, so let's take this from two ways.
Alarming.
There's one way to look at that, and that is absolute appalling, disgusting, horrifying behavior for any human being, especially someone who's the president of the United States. I think it's fair to say that's how you and I see that.
I completely agree.
The other side of that is you are looking at a politician who knows exactly who he is, knows exactly who he's speaking to, and is 100% comfortable in his message and his delivery. And the Democrats, if they're going to win, need at least a little bit of that.
I think they need the consistency and the assertiveness that he brings. They need to have that as part of their message. If you're a Trump loyalist, the way that they spin that is, oh, this is all part of a strategy. He knows what he's doing. This is all, you know. But, yeah, I think that the Democrats need to be disciplined enough to call it out when necessary, but not to get distracted and go down rabbit holes and be able to keep to the message. And the message is simple, that this is, you know, American norms have been violated.
Yeah.
We need a return to normalcy, that the country is suffering, that this is not the way that government should be conducted. And, you know, we are going to return ethical government to Washington.
And you're right. There's a level of nastiness in last night's rally that really is even turned up from
some of which rallies. Was way beyond even what we saw in previous
calling
rallies.
People stupid, calling people dumb, calling people sick. He said all Biden's ever done was kiss Obama's ass.
That specifically comes to mind. That was kind of a turning point.
Again,
saying that Biden was stupid, he's never been smart. Yeah.
If you can somehow rationalize that.
You had
that,
people chanting lock him up about Biden's son at the rally. Yeah,
he wants shirts that says where's Hunter. If you can somehow rationalize and excuse that behavior out of the president of the United States, you might just be a partisan hack at this point.
Right.
I mean, I think that says more about whoever is defending that than Trump, because we know what Trump's going to do.
Oh, completely. So I'm going to pivot for a second because I just thought about this. It's a tangent, but somewhat related. So when I was at Disney World, I went to the Hall of the Presidents. I don't know if you've ever been there. The animatronic presidents.
They're like the waxy animatronic ones.
Yeah, which they've refined, so they're more realistic than they used to be. Although
the last time I went and saw that, I was probably 9.
Okay.
So that would have been like 19, 78 or something.
Right.
And I remember they were horrifyingly robotic and terrible. They've probably been improved.
Improved, okay. Although the criticism is still that they're not, the likenesses aren't exactly like many of the presidents, especially the recent ones. But what stands out is they had just reopened the spring. It was shut down for a year. There was criticism because they hadn't added Trump's figure, and the criticism was that they were planning on Hillary being president and they were caught off guard, and so they didn't know what to do. So they have Trump there now, but what's interesting is they have him speak a little bit and talk about, you know, the greatest strength of America is its people. But there's an interesting caveat to that. After Trump speaks, they bring it back to the George Washington animatronic figure, and the George Washington animatronic figure expresses that despite all of our struggles, despite what may be happening today, we need to trust in the idea of the presidency.
Wow.
And that the idea of the presidency is more than any one person. And so I was watching this.
That's pretty harsh.
Wow, this isn't so subtle. I wonder how people are interpreting it. If you look online, there's like all of this like hate by Trump supporters.
Because I bet Trump supporters hate that.
Yeah, they have this. Part of the revamp was this whole discussion on the idea of the presidency and what it means, and believing in the idea. Yeah. Which is really interesting. But anyway, it kind of spoke volumes. And then I also read up that Trump for a while was obsessed with what they were going to do with his animatronic figure. And he was upset because I guess he told Disney that he wanted his figure, because, you know, when each of the presidents speaks, they say something about their accomplishments. He wanted his to talk about all of his success and property and real estate and business and to say something about that. And they're like, nope.
No. This and is so all the presidents.
They don't. Yeah. It's like, you don't understand what this is all about. Yeah.
Speaking of not understanding things, let's pivot to Turkey.
Yes.
And let's pivot to the Kurds in northern Syria. So again, this is one of those kind of weird, it's not a hard story to follow, but there are some nooks and crannies of this that we kind of have to unpack if we're really going to understand what's happening.
And
there.
This was a decision made in a vacuum without consultation, once again, with military, with State Department. And again, much of the foreign policy establishment completely caught off guard by this.
So I am not an isolationist, but I do think that we kind of
scale back,
send our military around sometimes.
Middle East. Well, that's fair. And I think there's a major argument to be made in light of Iraq and Afghanistan and the lack of progress.
Force.
Right, that we need to scale back our intervention, be very cautious about future engagement in the Middle East. And I believe in all of that, and I also believe in gradual troop drawdown. And there could be an argument to even make that for Syria. What's problematic with this is it's an announced withdrawal, which is probably one of the worst ways to withdraw troops. The commentary around in the days after that decision, and then also the fact that this is being done immediately. This isn't gradual. It's not methodical. Mm-hmm. We're not handing off the reins. We're just immediately pulling out and giving Turkey the green light to basically attack the Kurds, which we knew was going to happen, and it did. And despite Trump's statements, Turkey came out and said, we had a talk with him, and he knew this was going to happen.
We told him this was exactly agreed to. Happen. Yeah. So in northern Syria, there was a pocket where ISIS kind of retreated into.
Right.
And this is a weird part of the country because you've got Turkey. Turkey is a Islamically based country under Erdogan.
Right. Turkey has long been secular, but Erdogan has moved to being Islamic based. Yes.
Which aren't a big fan of the Turks and kind of actually liked ISIS where they were, because it gave them an excuse if they wanted to wade into Syria and wade into Kurdish territories. So basically, ISIS got bottled up. There's 50 or 60 Kurdish fighters from that northern Syria area who worked as the ground troops.
Yes.
And they basically told us, if you give us air cover training and some special forces help, we will do the bulk of the heavy fighting on the ground.
Yes.
So these 60,000 people, that we only had 1,000 troops there, but our 1,000 troops being on ground was enough to keep Turkey from entering into this confrontation. People don't understand. Just because we have if there's 1,000 U.S. soldiers somewhere, that impact and that statement can have far-reaching policy implications all over that region. And simply because we had troops there, we were sending a message. These are our folks. They're all allies. They're working with us. They are not to be touched and they are not to be messed with.
Exactly.
And help me if I'm wrong, but I will find some places to agree with the president. I'm not big on endless wars. I'm not big on endless occupation. Moving forward, isn't that the way, though, we're going to have to do this? What we were doing with the Kurds in Turkey, small special forces, air for controlling air, providing them air support, giving them training. They do their own fighting.
This wasn't a massive troop deployment. No. This was very small. Yep. It was centered on assisting the Kurdish forces on the ground. So this is probably the best type of deployment you could do because it was a small, sustained force, empowering the local forces, so that eventually we could withdraw them when the time was right. So, you know, we had already made those, basically taken those steps that are necessary to hand off the reins of power. And the Kurds, I think, had 11 to 12,000 ISIS fighters that had been captured that they were in charge of in their keep. And so, you know, now we basically face those ISIS fighters, you know, being released back into...
There's reports that's already happened.
Yes.
Because, again, if I'm worried about a Turkish invasion...
If you're being attacked...
And being attacked.
Yeah.
Hey, I don't have time necessary to look at everybody what's going on over there where we're trying to keep all those prisoners.
This is also extremely bad for troop morale, especially the troops that have formed relationships with these Kurds and have been working alongside them for so long. And the fact that we're going back on our word, because the Kurds have assisted us in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah.
They have been our allies in so many different scenes of war in the Middle East. And now we're deserting them. And so, and again, it's the United States not being able to be trusted when we give our word.
So I hope this comes out right. I'm putting this together in my head, and I hope I can articulate this correctly. I've never been in the military, never been in special forces. So if I say something wrong, feel free to brutalize me here on the mic. And we have some ex-military folks that listen. Feel free to send me a nasty gram. But if you're the type of person who joins the special forces, you feel it that strongly. You feel the need to represent our country. Even potentially on the field of battle, because that's just who you are as a person.
Well, yeah,
and that's the way you feel about
this. Is also the best of the best in terms of their training and the threats they face, because they are right there, front and center.
These people
threats.
Did not join the service to be stationed in the United States.
No.
These are a special group of people that we can't understand how they think or how they feel, because they feel this so strongly. If you're the best of the best of our armed forces and you joined it, as long as the mission, I think you believe in the integrity of the mission, which by all accounts, these people believed in this.
Yes, they knew what they
whole heart,
were doing.
Their whole minds, this is exactly what they want to be doing.
Right.
Don't fall for this. Oh my God, if you had to look at these people and Walter Reed in the face, you'd bring all of our troops back too. That's kind of a pander.
Yeah.
Because most of the people that I've known or talked to that made it to that level high up in military service, this is why they joined. They didn't join to sit at home.
Yeah.
And it's an absolute tragedy anytime any of our military servicemen die overseas. But I think if you ask those folks, what should we be doing? It's like, we need to be standing shoulder to shoulder with the people who did the heavy lifting for us on the ground.
Agreed. I mean, they undertook that advanced training for a reason.
Yeah.
So that they could use it in the battlefield, so that they could be part of these joint operations. And, you know, they have been assisting the Kurdish fighters now for years. And so they are now in this position where they have to turn their backs on them. And just, again, just anecdotally from what I'm hearing and reading, that this is causing a lot of strife, you know, out there for them. And as you imagine it would, because, again, they see the, you know, greater purpose for why they're there and who they're assisting.
Yeah.
And it puts them in a very bad place.
This,
so that's where we find ourselves in.
Taps into the purpose they worked so hard to become,
right?
Elite special forces fighters. And then just to have this yanked out from them on a Sunday night and be told, pack your shit and leave. I can't imagine that has a positive impact.
No, not at all. And let's not forget, Trump tried to do this in December and he was stopped.
Yes.
Cooler heads prevailed, but those cooler heads are no longer there. We don't have Kelly. We don't have Mattis.
Yep.
The administration is empty of those, I would say, kind of top tier pragmatic policy strategists, especially on the military side. And so that's where we find ourselves. There's nobody to control the worst impulses of the president.
And by all accounts, this was not the agenda they were going to discuss.
No.
This was off point, off topic. And nobody was there to interject to say, you're making a mistake. Do you feel, too, Republicans pounced on this? Do you feel this was kind of a way for them to let off some steam, to complain about something about the president? without crossing over into the impeachment argument.
I think so, because the case is so clear cut and there is such unified agreement on this being the wrong decision. So there isn't any downside for them. Trump may be upset and unhappy with them speaking out, but there is unity on this. And so they're not going to be left hanging. And it's easier for them to make this case to their voters that Trump is wrong than they can on Ukraine.
100%.
Where anything else can be painted as a partisan effort. And then they have to defend why they are also taking the side of Democrats. And in this case, that's not part of the defense at all.
Because Turkey sees the Kurds as a threat, and they see them as a terrorist force. So
they want to wipe out the Kurds.
Absolutely.
And again, geopolitically, this strengthens Turkey's hand in the region, and especially in Syria. It strengthens Russia, because we know Russia has troops in Syria and is operating there. So this emboldens our enemies, those that, and especially those state actors that do not have our interests at heart. And so long term, it creates instability. We have the exodus of ISIS fighters and not being able to track them, you know. And then the president has compounded the problems that this presents with his statements. He made the asinine statement that the Kurds didn't help us in World War II. Like, where did that come from? And then he followed that by saying, well, you know, it's okay that, you know, ISIS fighters will escape to Europe. So somehow that's good that, you know, if they go to Europe.
Did you see there's a whole bunch of people standing behind Trump when he said, well, they didn't help us in World War II. And you could visibly see
the looks
see,
on their faces. Like, yeah.
Oh, God. I can't believe I'm standing here.
I can't remember which. It was the congressman from North Carolina, the one who's been a big Trump backer. In the House, and he was standing right to the left on, I guess, the president's right, and he had that expression where
it just
like,
drains out of his face. Let's remind everybody, too, Turkey is a NATO ally.
Yes.
So I was really confused by, we're going to pull this small amount of troops out, which basically gives a green light to Turkey to launch an invasion, more like a massacre of the Kurds. They basically told us they were going to do this. We all know what's going to happen.
Right.
And then Trump comes out and says, if they do that, I will devastate
their economy. Yeah.
Have we ever threatened a NATO partner with devastating their economy?
No, I've never heard that threat made like that. So, let alone a non-NATO ally who's not an enemy. But yes, I mean,
So we're in this big organization together that makes us allies because we have common purpose. And then I'm going to pull out of an area, you're going to invade it, and then I'm going to punish you somehow.
But should we be surprised at this at all, Craig? Because with the president, you know, those types of alliances and partnerships and agreements don't matter. NATO doesn't really matter. None of this matters because in Trump's mind, everything is transactional. So, of course, NATO isn't going to come to mind and he's going to threaten Turkey because everything is transactional in his mind. That's what it comes down to.
And he only transacts with people he likes.
Yes.
He has to have a personal relationship, personal connection.
Relationships are fleeting. There is no stability because day to day, week to week, month to month, you know, one transaction, you could be in the good graces of the president, and then the following day, not so much. And so there is no long-term stability, which is why we find ourselves where we do.
So I agreed with Lindsey Graham when he called this a pre-9/11 mentality, that it's not our business what's happening over there. These people have been fighting for centuries. We need to stay out. I agree with him that that type of isolationism is how you get things like 9/11.
Right.
And I'm not for an endless war.
There's a difference between isolationism and foreign policy realism. As a realist, you are methodical and cautious about foreign intervention, but you're not opposed to it where it's necessary to prevent threats to the homeland, for example. Whereas an isolationist is basically extreme to where they don't want to be involved or intervene at all in the world. And they want to scale back everything. You know, someone who is like a neoconservative wants to be involved in multiple places, extend the U.S. military presence as far as it can go with no timetable, open-ended commitments. And so oftentimes, again, we go to these extremes, but there is a middle, and that's realist when it comes to foreign policy.
As a foreign policy realist, wouldn't you agree with, after our experience in Iraq, we are never going to put boots on the ground in the Middle East again?
Not in the foreseeable future. There's no appetite for that.
No.
And there, that crosses partisan lines, too.
There is no way you're going to sell to the American public, we need a 300 to 400 to 500,000 troop engagement somewhere in the Middle East.
Right. I don't think that's happening.
We care what's happening. We didn't do it in Syria when they were trying to kill off all their own people. So what gets me is that if boots on the ground in mass is not an option anymore, this is how we were going to ally up and kind of make sure that our interests were represented in the Middle East, now that we've taken this off the table, because no one really is going to partner with us on a local level for quite some time.
No,
after we pull this shit,
we've lost their trust, and we've lost their credibility throughout this episode. So there is no incentive for others to partner with us because, you know, there is no long-term, there's no commitment there.
So under the Trump doctrine, isolationism is the only thing left.
Right.
If we're not going to use our military in force and we're not going to build relationships and help at the local level, the only thing we have left is to pack up and kind of come home.
It's a very strong form of isolationism in terms of our involvement abroad, but that mindset also extends to obviously immigration as well. And again, for all the talk about illegal immigration, I mean, the fact can't be lost that the Trump administration really wants to restrict legal immigration as much as possible. Yeah. The other night at his rally, Trump was bragging about how he is restricted and is preventing refugees from coming into the country. And this,
asylum
he's very
seekers,
proud of that.
Refugees. Yeah.
So, you know, this fits into his whole mindset of how he approaches these issues, is he does not want us involved abroad at all, and he does not want to allow immigration into the country, really, from abroad. He wants to restrict that as much as possible.
So do you think Kim Jong-un is saying, well, hell, I'm going to call Trump this Sunday night? Maybe I can get him to pull out of South Korea.
The world leaders, I think, have woken to the fact. I mean, that Ukrainian phone call transcript really said it all in terms of how you suck up to Trump and get him on your good side. And you just, and I think they all know that. And so they know the trick. There is no strategy on Trump's part. I mean, he's played like a fiddle by all of these leaders, and it doesn't take much.
Two things can be true at one time. It could be true that Trump moved all of his transcripts with foreign leaders to the super secret secure server,
right?
Because it's the leakiest White House of all time. That definitely could be true.
That could be true, yeah.
It could also be true that his staff encouraged him to do that because they know there is a treasure trove of immoral, unethical, and illegal activity hidden within those calls.
And exactly. And if there was nothing wrong with these calls, why did so many White House officials immediately, their reaction was to, we need to hide these. We need to prevent them from being seen.
Yes.
We need to put them away. That does not speak to confidence about, you know, that everything is on the up and up.
Let's end with Shep Smith announced he's leaving Fox News. It's Friday. We typically do these on Thursdays. Shep Smith, their afternoon, one of the real straightforward news guys at Fox, announced after 23 years. He was one of the founding first people to kind of start the network, is leaving. This usually wouldn't be that interesting, except that Attorney General Barr
met with
Rupert Murdoch like Wednesday night.
Yeah.
And suddenly now the one outspoken critic of the president on Fox News and founding journalist members of that organization steps down unexpectedly after 23 years.
And this comes in the context of the president's tirades against Fox News have reached a crescendo.
Classic.
Escalated completely.
I mean, there's been some tweets in the past 2 weeks that my 17-year-old son could have done a better job at.
Yeah.
And there are tweets that gone out by saying the pollsters at Fox News suck because they've always been bad to me.
Right.
And I liked one where he basically endorsed OANN, the One America News Network.
Yeah.
Basically saying, well, if Fox isn't going to treat us right, here's some content and some content from this news source that can take that, that can fill that void if Fox isn't going to step up and do what they did for me in the 2016 election. In any other year, I would have said, you're crazy. If you would have told me the President of the United States would dispatch the Attorney General to meet with a media executive to specifically get somebody removed from the air.
Nothing's crazy anymore. Eh,
I could totally envision 9 scenarios where that actually happened.
Shepard Smith is the representation of the hard news component of Fox News. He is the one that is always kind of setting the record straight and contradicting what the pundits like Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity are saying. In some cases, he's all but calling the pundits on his network out by name.
Absolutely.
Which puts him in the cross.
Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity. He goes at them on a regular basis.
So he is the, I would say, target of the president's scorn in most cases. So not surprising at all, I think, in that context. But, you know, it will be interesting in the coming days to see what, you know, Shepard Smith says about it, who he's replaced with, what more we find out. I'm sure things will leak out from Fox News. They always do.
That's interesting. Who is he going to be replaced with?
Yeah.
That'll
be more telling than
because
anything.
That slot is a news slot. It's not an opinion slot. You're right. Who they put in there really could be telling to what the direction is, or what pressure maybe came from the top to make that change.
That'll be very revealing. I did want to add one final thing into the week. So there was a big brouhaha over Ellen with George W. Bush at the Dallas Cowboys game. Yeah. She was called out apparently for that, and she said,
"Hey, next to a war criminal."
Right. She's like, "I'm friends with George W. Bush. We don't agree on everything. I'm a liberal. He's not." But she's like, you know, it, basically for her, it came down to philosophy: be kind to everybody.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it's interesting the blowback that she's getting, because I feel like in another day and age, like, we would have been questioning this at all, because I mean, the fact that you can't have friends with somebody and differ with them on policy, or that people can't change on policy, or have, I think it definitely plays into a how polarized we are in this country, but also this very black and white mentality that once we convict somebody for something, that they can't be forgiven, you know, that they kind of, and we've talked about that in other contexts, but I just find that very fascinating to watch a reaction to that, and those that, you know, basically are on Ellen's side and saying, yes, we need more of this, and not those that are upset and say, no, like, you know, how can you be friends with them?
So I struggle with this, because this is where, again, I can see both sides. The normal adult centrist in me agrees 1,000% with what you just said. Come on, guys. You're telling me that two people from the opposite ends of the political spectrum can't watch a football game together? That is utterly and totally ridiculous. I also understand the argument that George W. Bush represents a party and a party and an ideology that at times has been destructive to the LGBTQ movement. And how can you, as one of the absolute pioneers of that movement, sit next to him? There is some grains of truth to that. I understand how there was somebody who tweeted something in an article I read, who's like, you know, I'm a middle-aged guy. I'm gay. It took me years to come to terms with it. I have been put down, bullied, denied jobs, everything that comes along with being a minority.
Yeah.
How dare you sit next to that guy and legitimize some of the things he's done and said and policies he's endorsed to the LGBTQ community?
Well, and I think the big one was gay marriage, because at the time Bush argued for a constitutional amendment against gay marriage. But I would say, let's not forget the time that we're talking about, 15 years ago, almost 16 years ago, very different time and place in the gay marriage debate. At that time, there was a majority support in the country, as there is now, in support of gay marriage. So going by that, at that time and place, I mean, if you were not going to be friends or be friendly to somebody who disagreed with you on gay marriage, you're talking about over half of the country. And the thing is, our country has evolved on that. And how do we not know that maybe the President Bush himself has evolved on that.
True.
Because we know that his wife and actually his daughters are very outspoken in
yeah.
gay rights and gay marriage, and he may be too now.
Yeah.
But again, I feel like we don't even give the benefit of the doubt as far as time goes.
Yeah.
That was also at the same time where Barack Obama was against gay marriage and Hillary Clinton was against gay marriage.
Barack Obama
and
wasn't hip to gay marriage day right. one either.
And so if we...
That's a valid point.
If we can, you know, give them the, you know, forgive them and move on, and but we don't even give the president the benefit of the doubt in this case. And again, I think time and place is key. You know, if this was President George W. Bush today advocating a constitutional amendment against gay marriage, I would, you know, it would yeah. be a whole different thing. But it's also striking to me how people reacted the way they did. It's, I would say a different case today is we had Kanye West, who has allied himself with Donald Trump, who, you know, I think we can all argue is destructive on a level we've never seen.
Yes.
And on gay rights, because if you look at the Trump administration's yes, record on gay rights,
not very friendly, 100%.
But it's just, it's interesting to see. I haven't seen that same level of reaction when it's come to Kanye West and his support for Donald Trump as I have people just kind of cringe and move on. I don't know. It's just, I see, you know, difference there and a disconnect. And I think people are way too quick to say, don't be friends, rather than say, well, time has passed.
The only thing that makes me take one step back is that same article that the guy had written, the gentleman who was gay, talking about Ellen,
yeah.
is, I know you're all going to say that's in the past, it's a different time. When you're part of a kind of that oppressed minority, when is it time? You know, how long do you have to wait? What is the statute of limitations on something? And I think, again, if George Bush has changed his mind on gay marriage, it would only be because of maybe the pressure that his family and other people put on him.
But that's an assumption. I mean, how
true.
Do we know that?
I guess what I'm trying to say is if I were any type of racial or any type of minority where I felt like my rights were not being fully recognized in this country,
yeah.
being told to forgive and to wait and things will change, I think people are just standing up and saying, we're tired of that. We're done with that. We've waited long enough.
I understand that, but things have changed. I mean, that's my whole yeah. argument here, is that the country has moved, and part of that has been people who have friends and relatives and neighbors that are gay
yeah.
have come to understand that issue in a different light. And so the way I see it is, if you're going to hold that against him, there were many others that held that view who have since evolved as well. And that's what's the statute of limitations for
true.
Holding that up and saying, you know, well, you were against our right to marry back then, and I'm not ready to move past that.
I think one of the silliest things you can do in life is hold grudges.
Yeah.
It doesn't do you any good. It's like a weight you carry with you. You can weigh yourself down that you never move forward.
I agree. And I just think with any issue, the longer we are on this trajectory of where we think we can't be friendly or speak to people on the other side, I think the more difficult it becomes to find consensus. The logjam, the yeah. deadlock, the gridlock we've seen, all of that is a result of this idea that we're so polarized we can't talk to each other.
Yeah. And something that supports kind of what your perspective is on this, Joy Behar said, I've had an opportunity to meet W and I never did because I knew I'd like him.
Yeah.
He's like, I knew, because you could just tell by his personality, he's probably pretty fun to be around. She's like, I could see myself watching a football game with him. She's like, I won't even take the chance of meeting him and talking to him because I'm against his policies so adamantly.
Wow.
And that kind of proves the point you're making. How can anything change if just by the perception I have of who you are, I won't even take the time to meet or talk with
and
you?
And I just can't imagine.
Because I'm afraid I might actually like you.
And I can't imagine that philosophy, that your policy positions would be so strong that you're not willing to meet or speak to anybody at all, just yeah. solely based on that. Because again, we don't grow, and I think we both talked about this, because I read and digest and consume information on both the left and the mm-hmm. right, because if you don't yep. understand the other mindset, you can't grow
absolutely.
In how you think
yep.
either.
Yeah. If you're just filling your day with podcasts and news clippy or Twitter, your Twitter feed and news from the right or the left, you're completely missing the point. And you're missing such a great age because there's so much great information.
Oh, there's so much content that you can consume and so many viewpoints and perspectives.
You can walk down like three never or four before. Podcasts a week and take an hour deep dive into all of these different issues from all sides and really come away with a much better understanding.
Exactly.
And we've never had that opportunity, I don't think.
No, we're living in a golden age of information.
We're living in a golden age of television, Brandon. I talk about this all the time.
Yes.
My new TV thing for the fall is Big Mouth on Netflix. Have you watched this?
Oh, no, I haven't. What is this about?
If you like dirty, adult-oriented cartoons,
okay,
this is definitely your genre.
And this is a Netflix original?
It's a Netflix original. Okay. It's a cartoon about kids coming of age in middle school, so it's full of sex and body humor and stuff like that.
Oh, I did hear about this. I saw the creator interviewed on something. Yeah.
So this is something that plays right to my, you know, internal 12-year-old and highly, highly entertaining.
Nice.
If you're looking to pick up something that you can just mindlessly, you know, if you just don't want to think about anything and just want a few cheap laughs, Big Mouth is definitely the way to go.
Okay. I've started watching The Politician on Netflix, which is basically a high school student council president election, but it's cutthroat. There's, you know, murder involved, all kinds of stuff. It's kind of like if you ever saw the it reminds me of the 1999 film Election with Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah, I've seen that. Matthew Broderick.
It's dark like that, kind of dark comedy, but it's by Ryan Murphy, who's the guy behind American Horror Story and American Crime Story. So he's lent his craft to this, and it's intriguing. It's really dark, but it's funny, and it definitely pokes fun at kind of the nature of American politics.
Yeah.
But it's on a high school level, and you're watching all this take place, and you have these students talking about polling numbers going up and down, and you're like, wait a second, these are high school students. But I think that's part of it. It's supposed to be so ridiculous that we're like, hey, like this
somebody
speaks to us.
Somebody asked the question, and I think we've talked about this on the pod before, American politics, is it, Kevin Spacey, the big one. Oh, crap. House of Cards.
Yes.
Is it House of Cards? Is it Veep?
Oh, yeah.
House of Cards is a bunch of sinister, hyper-competitive,
Machiavellian,
and everyone's working a 4D chess strategy to get something done. Or is it Veep, where it's just a bunch of generally dumb people.
Dysfunctional.
Damaged.
Yep. Right.
Washed out in a bunch of different things.
Idiotic.
Just got thrown into this circumstance.
Incompetent.
And the circumstances are ridiculous.
Right.
And they just do ridiculous things.
Yeah, where you find yourself laughing and smirking, whereas House of Cards is cutthroat, it's dog-eat-dog, it's
but
very dark.
Everything is planned and thought and part of
methodical.
A master plot by somebody pulling the levers, where Veep is just a bunch of random things happen, and these people react horribly to it.
You know, and I feel myself going back and forth on that, so maybe we're both, and maybe we alternate between both.
I think we're 51% Veep, 48% House of Cards.
Okay.
That there's some of both, but
yeah, I think sometimes we're too willing to overlook the incompetence
Never, what's the phrase? Never assign malfeasance to what you can explain with incompetence.
Right.
And I think that's pretty much a definition of the political world we live in right now.
And that's why I don't believe in conspiracy theories, because that assigns too much responsibility.
They're too hard.
Yeah.
I mean, have you ever tried to lie to three people consistently?
Oh, yeah.
You can't do it.
No.
There's no way. All right. That's our hour.
Thanks, Craig.